Everyone, recordings have now been started. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the RPM sub-team for URS Providers call on Wednesday, the 11th of April, 2018. On the call today, we have Martin Silva, Cynthia King, Philip Corwin, Susan Payne, and Lori Schulman. We have apologies from Jonathan Agman and Michael Karanikolas. From staff, we have Ariel Lang, Andrea Glandon, and myself, Julie Bisland. As a reminder, please state your name before speaking for transcription recording purposes, and please keep your phones on mute when not speaking to avoid background noise. If you would like to make a comment or ask a question on the call today, please feel free to chime in as you see fit. Just state your name, of course, and ask to be placed into the queue. With this, I will turn it back over to Phil Corwin. Please begin.
Yeah, thank you, and good morning, afternoon, and evening to everybody on the call. This is our last sub-team call. Our main focus on this call is going to be to run through the edited questions and see if we think they're in shape for forwarding them to the full working group for consideration starting next week when we will be returning to full working group calls as of Wednesday, the 18th. So let me see. The secondary assignment was to look at the MFSD and ADN-DRC supplemental rules and see if there was anything unique about them or anything that seemed to be out of compliance with the ICANN rules and procedures other than what we've already noted for the Asian Domain Name Dispute Resolution Center, that they only use email to inform the respondent, which is seems to be out of sync with the rules and procedures. Whether so, I don't know if anyone did that. I meant to do it, but I got so caught up yesterday with editing the questions, I didn't finish that. So if anybody's done that and has noticed anything they think we should take note of, I'm going to ask them to speak now. Otherwise, we can circle back to that at the end of the call. If we have time, we can also deal with that on the email list over the coming week before the full working group call. So has anyone reviewed those? We did review the forum supplemental rules. Did anyone review the other two supplemental rules and note anything they wanted to bring to our attention?
Phil, it's Lori. I'm going to own that I have not done the homework. A lot of us are doing who is homework at the moment, so sorry.
That's okay. We don't grade in this course.
All right. But I'm
and everybody gets their certificate for showing up at the end. It's a very progressive school we're running here. So in terms of how to proceed, what I did, how I spent my day yesterday, was editing the raw questions, putting them in a form suitable to send to the individual providers. Now, a lot of this was just where it said, do the providers, I said, you know, I struck that and said, do you, so it's a question to each provider, and I made some, I don't think I made any real substantive changes. I made changes for the purpose of clarifying the focus of the question and getting meaningful objective responses. So what I would suggest, I think it's relatively legible, is that we run through, if you got your email today, Justin Chen did a slight markup of my red line, and that's what I'm going to be working off. So we have my changes, his few edits of my changes, and did I say Chen? I meant Chu for his name. I apologize for that. And then Michael K. Sennon's 2 points he wanted raised when we get to examiners, which we can discuss at that point. So is everyone okay working off Justin's edit of the red line, which you can find by opening your email from this morning? I'm not sure yet if it's in the document room.
Fine by me, Phil. Just to say, I think Justine is a girl with an E on the end.
I further apologize. And no offense meant. I hope none was taken.
I'm sure there wasn't, but I just thought I'd correct you at the start of the call.
I appreciate that, too. No, I don't want to make that mistake again. All right, so let's do that. And we're going to do this fast. We're not going to read every question because this is 16 pages and we have 90 minutes. So basically, I'm going to rely on you folks to be following along, to have this document in front of you. Is there anyone who doesn't have that capability who's on the call? Because we don't have a chat room today. There's no WebEx that's being used. Apparently, ICANN just has two licenses and two WebEx rooms. So that's what we'll do. We're going to run through fast, and if you're fine with the edit, that's it, and we'll move on to the next question. And if you're not, speak up. So starting on page one with communications, who's that?
Una carta rebotada, una clienta de Alex.
Excuse me?
Sorry, one moment. We'll try to find that line and mute it.
Yeah, I did not understand what that person was saying. It was in a language I did not recognize. So we're starting with page one. First topic is communications. I consolidated the first two questions into one that says, please provide us with information regarding the means by which you communicate with complainants and respondents, including relevant provisions of your supplemental rules. The next question is only to the Asian Domain Name Dispute Resolution Center, which is about asking them to explain why they only notify respondents by email rather than also using the means of fax and postal mail that seem to be required by the ICANN rules and procedures. That's spurred by that provision of their supplemental rules.
Can I chime in here? Because I didn't like the negative question. Explain how you're not in breach. Maybe we should ask it positively and say you've indicated that you only communicate in email. Please explain why you do this, given the fact that the rules say otherwise. In other words, let them explain why they're doing it rather than accusing them of being in breach. I don't think that's our role. How are you not in breach? I would just say we've noticed, you know, you said this. We're wondering why you do it, given that the rules say that. That's how I would draft that question.
Yeah, I'm fine with changing that spin on the question, or I would just want to ask them to explain how their rule is consistent with the ICANN rules and procedures, rather than, you know, don't use the breach word, but ask for a rationale for how that's compliant.
Right, I think we're saying the same thing.
Okay, so staff, take that down and please revise the question per Lori's suggestion and my comments on that. So then the next question is again about the means of communications to complainants and registrants by non-electronic means, and asking, I added the specific second part, what alternative means are utilized, just to make sure we get a response on that. Rather, because the first part just asked about percentage that wasn't electronic. We'd like to know what that is. Next question five, it's just changed to be asking them, how do you conform rather than how do the providers? And that you'll see that a lot. A lot of the changes in this are just changing the providers to you, since it's going to three separate dispute resolution providers. So that's the same and only change on questions 6, 7, and 8, which brings us to the complaint.
Phil. Sorry, Susan. Can I ask a quick question, which is the only thing we're asking them then here is whether they start their time periods running in accordance with 2G. Is that right?
In question five?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really the focus of the question.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was clear since 2G is cited, but okay. And again,
I guess the reason I was asking was just because it then, you know, 2G then refers back to 2S, and I didn't, I'm sorry, I don't have 2S in front of me at this moment, but I just didn't know whether we actually want them to be confirming they're complying with both. I don't know the answer. I'm sorry.
I don't have 2F handy to look at. Maybe we can circle back on that one. Maybe staff can take a look at 2F, and when we get to the end of the next section, get back to us and explain what 2F says. So, by the way, since we don't have any ability to raise hands because we're not in a room, just do what you're doing. Speak up. I won't take offense. First question about whether they accept complaints without all the elements, asking to provide their forms, and I added identify any deviations from form 3B. And 3B is reproduced below in that question. In question two, again, I made it to you. And added the clause that if they ask for additional information, it says, if so, please provide the relevant provision of your supplemental rules. So, again, on some of these, I just said, well, you know, rather than go back and say, why didn't we ask that, you know, let's get it all in one question and not ask them to come. We don't want to be going back to these people again and saying, oh, we forgot to ask the second part. The next one is important given the ongoing discussion of GDPR and who is, and I rephrase this question. Let's see if you agree with the rephrasing. Have you encountered any issues receiving who is information? Info should be information. We can add that. It should be the full word. Needed for URS proceedings when dealing with complaints against registrants from EU nations due to privacy laws / regulations. And then I noted that this probably should not be in the complaint section. That really arises later in kind of what they do after the complaint is received. So we can consider what section that should be in. And also thinking about this, this might be expanded to it's not just registrants from the EU, but when they have to deal with registries or other contracted parties based in the EU. And, of course, this is looking backwards since they wouldn't have any experience with GDPR enforcement. I think that's touched on in a later question. So let's stop there and see if there's discussion on this question.
Yeah. Hi, sorry, Phil, it's Susan. Can I get in the queue?
You're in the queue. You're first.
I am the queue. Okay. I wonder if we should, if we maybe don't limit it to EU nations. I mean, I'm sure this is sparked by the kind of GDPR situation, but some of the comments that people in the community have made throughout the discussions about GDPR is, why are we focusing on that? Because there are privacy laws in other countries as well. So also, in fact, because the, you know, to the extent that something like the ICANN interim model got adopted, then that's not making a distinction between EU and non-EU anyway. So I wonder if maybe we should make it territory neutral. Does it make any difference? It seems to me it would work sufficiently well if we did that.
Okay. So you would amend this to just read with complaints due to privacy laws / regulations and leave out the reference to registrants from EU. I'm fine with that if other people
and
are fine.
Maybe we ask them if so in relation to which country or something. Because otherwise we might just get an answer that says yes.
I think that's a good suggestion. There could be a follow-up clause if you have what countries or regions have generated the problem.
Yeah.
Something like that. Okay. I'm assuming staff has taken notes on all this, where we want to amend a question.
This is Aria from staff. Just quickly, I'm taking notes directly on the Google Docs, so you,
the people on the Google Doc can see the edits real time.
Oh, okay. Okay, I'm working off my my Word document here, but that's fine. And then there are question four has two parts. Part A is to the forum, and part B is to the Asian Dispute Center, and they're very fact specific on the their online input technology, and I added the clause in the same manner as MFSD because apparently we have some background from. By the way, staff, I don't know if anyone's looking at the document that shows where we've already gotten answers from the providers on any of these questions, but you know, I'm not. I have that open separately, but I'm looking to if we have received answers, I hope staff will speak up and we can consider whether the question is still needed in light of the information we've already received. Because we don't want to be asking a lot of questions. We're saying, why are we asking that again? We already gave them an answer. Do they want a different answer?
Understood, Phil. And just to answer a question, the first question in the communication section has already received answers. The question one under communications. That's the one so far.
Okay, that was the one I revised. It starts, please provide us with information, et cetera?
Yes.
All right. Well, let me ask the group, since we've already gotten responses and since we've already reviewed their supplemental rules, should we just drop that question? Any responses?
Well, hi, Phil. Susan. I suspect we don't need to ask it anymore. But I guess we're kind of all agreeing that a bit off the on the hoof. So, I mean, what we've got is I think maybe we have to spend a bit of time just making sure we think the response is sufficient. But I don't know if we're going to have time to do all of that and get through this document as well.
Yeah. All right. Let's note that for all the ones where we have responses, let's note that in the Google Doc, and we can decide after this call whether it would be prudent to drop the question where we already, if we decide the response we have and the other research we've already done is sufficient, and we don't need any further response. I mean. It's not a large burden to ask them again, but I don't want to. We will be sending them a lot of questions. I don't think we should be sending questions that have already been asked and answered to reduce the burden on them. So we'll do it that way. So that brings us down to question four on the third page. Yes.
Sorry. I was also thinking, actually, Ariel has produced this very nice kind of consolidated document that's the other document. And so it is possible. I mean, we may feel that a response is satisfactory, but one thing we might be able to do is send the questions in that form maybe and say to them, you know, we've got we've got the responses you've provided to us. Is there, you know, please only answer it if there's anything else you want to add or something.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion. We could do it that way. On the ones where we already have response, although in some cases we might decide that we definitely want
might not be adequate. Yeah. I don't think we're going to get away with not looking at it.
Yeah, let's just bookmark. Let's just on each of the ones where we have response, note it, and you know, the main thing we want to do again on this call is get through the edited questions and make sure we're generally okay with them, and then we'll have a little cleanup work after that, working with staff on the Google Doc. So, continuing on, question four continues just with references to SMD files. I don't think there's anything minor edits there. Okay, section 5, I just clarified a bit to note that it's not the providers, but it would be the examiners determine that the domain was registered and being used in bad faith. It's a section about whether they found any grounds for determining that beyond what's in URS procedure 1.2.6.3. Just a clarification on section 6 that we're talking about, the word limit set for the complaint. Question 7. Again, just clarifications to make the question more understandable for them. Same on question 8. And again, I tried to avoid any substantive change in these questions. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, it might be late in the game, but on 8, do you check to determine whether a domain? Are you talking about just checking the plaintiff or checking court docs? Do you mean an electronic check or do you mean a?
Well, question 7. There's stuff in the rules and procedures about, domains already subject to, ongoing.
I'm sorry, I was talking about 8. I'm sorry, I skipped one, I think. I was talking about the court cases, not the U.S.
Yeah, well, I was trying to check question 7 asks about active URS UDRP. Question 8 asks about court cases.
Right, but I'm saying in the court cases, do we want to ask how does it matter? What they're doing, it may not. I mean, like you ask how for the URS or UDRP, but you don't ask how for the cases. That's all. It's just an inconsistency. I was just wondering why we ask in one but not the other. That's all.
Okay.
I think we want to ask how as well.
Yeah,
I think
we need to add how in A. That's all. So there's a question.
Oh, yeah. Okay. No, good point, Lori. And, so basically add the same second sentence to question 8 that's already in question 7.
Correct.
Done. Okay. Question 9 just clarified. Question 10. Again, these are all just grammatical tightening. Same for 11. Now, question 12 is a new question from Justine Chu. Let's read it together and decide whether we think it should be included. How many complaints have been dismissed as a direct result of the incorrect domain name registrant being named in a complaint, regardless of whether the domain name registered was subject to a privacy or proxy service? If so, were the complaints dismissed without prejudice? And then there's a parenthetical goes toward indications of a complainant filing errors versus who is accuracy and unreported changes in domain name registrations control, which are outside the complainant's control. I think if we accept this question, we ought to drop the parenthetical. I think that was Justine's explanation for the reason for the question, but I wouldn't think it would be included if we use the question.
Hi, Phil. This is Justine. Yeah, you're correct in that.
Oh, Justine?
Yes.
Apologies for mangling your name and gender earlier. Abject apologies. So you're on the call. Would you be fine with dropping the parenthetical from the question?
As you said, that was actually an explanation of why I included the question.
Okay. And I'm fine with the question. I think there might have been some other questions about privacy or proxy elsewhere, so we might want to move this. But I'm fine with keeping the question. Anyone else have views on that?
Hi, Phil, it's Susan. I'm okay with keeping the question, I think. But I was just looking at the information in the parenthetical that we're proposing to take out, and I agree with taking it out. But it seems like the explanation talks about giving an indication of where there were complainant filing errors versus who is accuracy errors. And I'm not sure that the question that we're asking is actually going to help us make that distinction. Because we just ask about where have they been dismissed. It doesn't actually say, you know, and if so, has it, you know, was it due to a complainant error or a, you know, or a who is inaccuracy error? So I'm not sure we're going to get the information that we're hoping for.
Would you want to add a third part to that question? Were you able to determine the cause of the?
Yeah. Maybe.
Do
people agree?
Mistaken. Identification, something like that?
I think so. Does that make sense, or am I misunderstanding?
That's fine. We could ask, how do we put this, how many complaints such as these were due to complainant filing errors as opposed to something else? Something along those lines.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let me propose that. All right. We keep the first question, and in between that and the second part, we put in a new question. Were you able to determine whether the mistake was due to a complainant error or to who is inaccuracy, and if so, please share your analysis with us. Something like that.
Yeah, that sounds fine to me.
Good. All right. Staff is capturing it. Next question. Time check. We're half an hour through, and we're on page 4, I believe. So going to have to pick up the pace a bit. First modification of the existing question was just for clarification. And this is the one on Well, I guess this isn't the same section as the previous who is question. This is a different one. So let's go through this carefully, because who is a hot topic. How will the URS rules pertaining to cases involving domains utilizing privacy or proxy services be affected if full access to WHOIS data is no longer publicly available to the GDPR implementation? So this is really not about data. It's asking about their view. And then I put in a second part, which does ask for more objective information, not just an opinion, which is, what WHOIS data elements do you require to perform your role as a URS dispute resolution provider? I think that's important information we need so that we can weigh in as a working group into the ongoing WHOIS GDPR discussion to make sure that the basic data that dispute resolution providers require to perform their functions continues to be available to them through some means. So are people okay with this question 13 as rephrased?
Sorry, it's Susan. Yes, but I wonder, why are we asking specifically about privacy proxy services? I mean, isn't any case going to, if there's an impact from about access to the WHOIS data, isn't that going to be impactful on any case, regardless of whether there's a privacy or proxy service provider involved?
Yes, good point, Susan.
Yeah. Well, I would only say I'm not playing devil's advocate. I think this is a specific reference to there are specific URS rules pertaining to what happens, how you get the data for a domain under privacy or proxy protection, And that's how this question started out.
Okay. So I agree then. Maybe we should keep it as it is. But perhaps after the first part of the question, so the first question sentence, maybe we could say, you know, what about domains not involving privacy proxy services or something, just so they cover both bases?
Okay. I'm just trying to wordsmith on the fly here.
I have a clarifying question.
Yeah.
Not about the questions. And this just goes to my lack of knowledge about how URS rules are developed. I know different entities have different rules, but isn't there a certain core group of rules that all entities...
Yes, Lori. There are ICANN rules that they must follow. There are ICANN procedures which explain how the rules should be implemented. And then each of the providers have their own supplemental rules, but the supplemental rules are only supposed to go to administrative matters and are not supposed to be able to deviate from the ICANN rules and procedures.
So then that's why I'm not sure why the question would even work, because any change to the rules, wouldn't that have to go through ICANN policy making first?
Well, no, there are existing rules for the URS for cases where the domain is under privacy and proxy protection.
So isn't the better question is how do you perceive the rules will change, not how the rules will actually change? I think it's a different question.
We're
looking at 13, right? How will the URS continue to cases involving domains be affected? Well, there's a whole stratified rule system that you just explained. So that's a big question, and I don't think anybody knows. I think it's a funny question. I think it only makes sense if you say, how do you think the rules ought to change? Do you think the rules ought to change? But not how, because that would be the result of an actual thing that will happen as a result of policymaking.
All right. Lori, while you've been talking, I've composed a new version of this question. Let me run it past the group.
Okay.
And so follow along with me. I'm trying to keep this thought together. How will the URS rules and procedures referencing access to who is data, comma, including the rules pertaining specifically to cases involving domains utilizing privacy or proxy services, comma, be affected, et cetera. So that change would bring in all cases, not just cases involving domains under privacy and proxy protection, and would reference both the rules and procedures. There are a number of them, and staff was supposed to compile those for us. We haven't heard back from them yet, which specifically reference access to and utilization of who is in the URS dispute resolution process. So I think my edit would cover everything that's been discussed there.
No, but I still think it doesn't answer my basic question. You're saying, how will the rules change? Doesn't matter which rule. How will the rules change? Well, we don't know, because some of those rules are going to change through a public policy process that the provider has no part of, right? I would almost rather say, you know, do you think the rules will change? Should the rules change? You know, I think we're not asking the right question. Because changing the rules is going to require potentially the change in the ICANN policy, then change in the own provider's internal policies, plus the procedures aspect of this. So they don't know. So
okay.
I'm still trying to figure out what we're trying to find out from them. How are they going to change their rules? How will you change their rules?
No, they can't change the rules. ICANN has to – any changes to the URS rules and procedures have to come from ICANN. They would come probably as a result of recommendations from this working group. Let me suggest this. We've got this question on who is. We've got the other question on the preceding, two pages preceding. Why don't we take this discussion offline? We've already spent more than 10 minutes on this one question. And I'll work with Ori, with you and Susan, and anyone else who's interested over the next 2 days to rationalize these questions so that I think we're trying to find out is whether there's going to be a conflict between what the current rules say and what GDPR says about what we think it's going to affect who is data. And then the second part that I put in, I want to know from them exactly what they need to perform their roles, because I think this group can perform a very valuable service by advocating for their continued access to those critical elements.
Right, but to my point, the second question to me makes sense. The first part of the question does not make sense. We know how the rules will change. They're going to change through a policymaking process, and we're going to figure it out. So I don't think asking the provider how the rules are going to change gives us any information unless we ask them, how would you like to see the rules change?
Well,
what suggestions do you have for new rules? And then it makes sense.
I think the question is really trying to ask them, will the rules still work if there are WHOIS restrictions? But again, I'm proposing that we pull out of this section, the complaints section, question 3, which deals with WHOIS, and question 13, and that you and Susan and I and anyone else who's interested work on that over the next 48 hours to put them in final form so we can move on to the rest of the document.
All right, but will you note, I think what you the way you just rephrased it is right, what you just said about how it was a how, it wasn't a how, it was a what question.
Right. Okay.
It's the how that I have the issue with. So I just would like that noted. So when we start this discussion again, we can start with my issues with the how. I don't think how is the right question.
All right. I'm going to ask staff to pull questions 3 and 13 out of this document, and after this call is over, to circulate them in their current edited form to Lori and Susan and I. And if anyone else wants to be part of that discussion, let us know before the end of the call, and we will work to get back a more focused and useful version of these questions relating to who is before the end of the week.
If that may add, under others, the page 14, the first question is the overarching question about GDPR. That's what you refer
to. Right. So. Well, let's throw that in, too. Let's make sure that all of our questions regarding GDPR and who is, that we need all of them and that they that they make sense. And maybe they should be in a new section on potential impact of GDPR. But we can determine that later. Let's move on to fees. It's edited to read, what are your filing fees for complainants and respondents? And then I put in parenthetical where applicable, because respondents only pay fees under certain circumstances. And then I changed the second part which before was just a comment. And now it's a specific question. Do you have any opinion regarding the design and feasibility of a loser pays model that could levy additional costs against a losing party to a URS? So it's an objective question. It asks for their professional opinion on feasibility of a loser pays model. People okay with that?
Bill, I had a question about the first part of the question.
Yes.
I think the answers are actually already found in the provider supplementary rules, so do we really want to ask that question again?
Good point. Yeah, I think we already have that information somewhere in the spreadsheet. I know the providers displayed that in San Juan. So maybe, Justine, maybe we should drop the first part of that question and just have a standalone question on asking for their views on design and feasibility of a loser pays model. What other folks think about that?
Yeah, that would be how I would approach
it. I agree.
Yeah, let's not ask them for data we already have from them.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
We don't want them to think we don't read what they send us. Okay. My edits of question two are just for clarification. Justine, I think this is your edit. Have you received feedback on whether your fee structure has been a major deterrent to the filing of complaints or responses? I'm fine with that. Anyone else?
Good to me.
I'll take heard one agree and silence otherwise, so we'll put in that question three. Okay, I just edited question one to make it more clear. And I broke question two into two separate questions, again, just clarifying them. Question three, the same. Question four, this was a somewhat confusing question. I edited it to read, have you received any notification of a non-delivery of communications? If respondents did not receive notification on the first attempt, how could they know of the complaint? What steps do you take if you receive notification of non-delivery? So drilling down a bit with those additions. Comments on that?
Sorry, Phil, just to prompt you, and I think I had a question for Ariel. What I'm looking at from the Word document and the Google Doc, there is a difference. In the Google Doc, after the section on fees, there is a section on administrative review. So I'm not sure whether Ariel just put that in, or was it, cut and paste from somewhere else in the document?
This is Ariel, and staff apologize for the oversight when we forwarded the questions to the subteam. There are two questions under administrative review that was left out when we did a copy-paste. So I just added to the Google Doc and make sure everything's captured there. So, Phil, just for your convenience, I'm going to read out these two questions. One is
okay. What section of the document are these questions supposed to be in? Just so I know what we're dealing with.
It's an administrative review. That's the section I left out completely. But there's only two questions on.
Oh, okay. All right. Let's stop and listen.
Word document, Phil. Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead and. And read those now, Ariel, and we can consider whether we need to edit them.
Okay. First one is, has there been any issue with regard to meeting the 2 business days requirement of conducting the administrative review? And the second question is, how many complaints have been found non-compliant?
Thanks, Ariel. Hi, it's Susan. Can I leap in, Phil?
Yeah. Please.
Because both of these, so the first question, the one about have there been any issues with the 2 business days, I'm looking at Ariel's other tracking document at the same time, and it looks like the Asian dispute people and the MFSD both answered that question already, but it doesn't look as though we have that answer from the forum. So maybe that first question, we only need to ask it to the forum. And then regarding question two, that's one where it's on Ariel's other document that they all three of them had answered it. So that's one of the ones that we need to just look at to see if we think the answer is adequate.
Okay. I see. I've got the spreadsheet document in front of me, which. Which jumps around very. Okay, so I see on the first question we already have responses from Asian Dispute Center and MFSD. So I agree we should only pose that question to forum since we don't have it. And then the second question, we've already got detailed responses from all of them, so I don't see any reason to ask that question. What others think?
That would be my sense. Yeah, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they did go into a certain amount of detail on that when we were in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, and basically, in most cases, it looks like the reasons have either been non-payment from the forum, or with the other two, people tried to use the URS against registries for which it is not yet available. .com in particular. So, yeah, let's drop that question. There's no need to ask them to give us the same answer.
I'm sorry again, it's Susan. I'm just for the avoidance of doubt, I'm assuming we're not going to drop them out of the lovely tracking table thing with all the answers in. I mean,
no,
I'm assuming they still stay in there. We're just not asking the questions.
Absolutely. Yeah,
good.
Talking about what additional questions are we sending to the providers.
That's what I thought, and I just suddenly had a moment where I got worried because obviously
if we have good answers, they're going to be kept. They're not being put into the memory hole for extinguishment. So let's move on. Notice of complaint and locking of domain. So we covered that, except for the last one, which is, do you have a view on the meaning of a normal domain name lifecycle? That's a quote. Then I put in parenthetical, this phrase is used in Registrar Requirement 2 and the ORS Technical Requirement. So just so they know what we're referencing. Again, response, I'm only going to stop at the ones where it's more than just a typographical clarification or striking the providers and putting in you. Question five, I added a question. It reads now, have you received any affirmative claims for relief by respondent for reasons beyond an allegation of abusive complaint? And then I added a second part, if you have, what was the basis of the claims? I guess we could add a third part, what decision was rendered on that claim, if people think we should ask that. Yeah, I'm going to suggest we add that third part. We may get an initial no, and that's the end of it. But if they got a claim on a basis other than an allegation of abuse, we ought to know how they treated it.
That's fine, Bill.
Okay. I'm looking through the others. On question 10, I added a second part. It says, can you identify any case in which the respondent was determined noncompliant for reasons other than nonpayment of the fee? If any, what were the reasons? We may already know that it's because they used it against a legacy TLD, but it can't hurt to ask. It's a little bit different than the other question. I embellished question 11. It asked whether they believe the deadline for filing responses is long enough. I added this second part. If not, what time period would you support, keeping in mind that the URS is supposed to operate with rapidity? So if they think it's not long enough, we want to know what they'd suggest. That would still be a rapid system.
Could we ask for some justification as well, Phil? So after the first part of that question, do you believe it's long enough? Could we just put something in that says, please give a rationale for your response? Because, if they say something like, we've had, you know, 30% of our cases where people have missed the deadline by a day or, you know, something like that, then that's useful
okay.
information.
How about, do you believe the deadline for filing the responses is long enough? And if not, why not? If not, comma, why not? That would say, if you don't think it's long enough, tell us why. Does that work for you?
Yeah, I guess I'd quite like them to support it by more than just an opinion. You know, do you know what I mean? I'd like them to give us some evidence as to why it's not long enough, rather than just a, you know, the random opinion of the person who fills the form in.
Yeah, no, I agree. So let's, in the aim of moving on quickly, let's put in my edit, but Susan, that doesn't foreclose you from getting back with a more detailed edit, and I'm fine if it works on question 11 here. Okay?
Yeah, I think, sure. Why don't we just remove the words, and if not, and just say, do you believe the deadline for filing responses is long enough? Please provide your rationale. So they can explain.
Yeah, okay, so yeah, that would add to the first question. And if not, please explain your rationale. Please provide your rationale.
You don't have to specify if not. You can also ask if they do believe that the deadline is long enough, then provide your rationale why.
No, I'm going to disagree there. The second question that I put in was asking them specifically, you know, if they say, well, it's not long enough because we've had a bunch of responses that showed up a day or two late, the second part says, okay, you've said you don't think it's long enough. You told us a rationale. Now, what are you suggesting it should be? It's a different question. It's asking them to suggest a specific period of extension beyond what's now provided to respondents. You know, again, I'm trying to avoid having to go back and ask more questions once we get responses. You know, it's going to take them a couple hours to respond to all these questions. So what's another 1 minute to ask them, you know, if you think it should be longer, by how many days?
No, I understand where you're getting at, Phil, but what I'm trying to say is, do we want to ask them for their rationale regardless of whether they, well, sorry, do we want to ask for their rationale even if their answer is positive to the first part of the question, which is, do you believe the deadline for filing responses is long enough?
No, no, I think they could answer question 11 by saying, yes, we believe it's long enough. And that's the end, that's all they have to say.
So we don't want to know why they believe it is so.
Hi, Phil, can I leap in?
Yeah.
Susan, I guess I think I'm in the same camp as Phil here, Justine. I understand where you're getting to, and I was pondering on this, but I think on the whole, you know, we have a response period. It's already set in the rules, and so it is what it is, unless someone gives us a good rationale and an explanation as to why it needs to be different.
Okay.
I don't think there's any suggestion. Otherwise, it just doesn't change.
Yeah. Thanks, Susan. You know, and I would just add to that my general view on all of this with the URS is that, hey, we all acknowledge that it's not perfect, that many of us would like this part or that part changed, but the rules emerge from a very long process of discussion and compromise within the community that took place a number of years ago, and my personal view on any particular question doesn't matter, because there's going to have to be a really good reason to justify a consensus to change any of this. So it's, you know, my basic assumption is that the URS is going to look pretty much the same at the end of this review as it does now, unless we find specific problems that need to be addressed. That's where I'm coming from.
I just wanted to ask whether this was one of those questions where you want more than just a yes and no answer. But if you're trying to get at if the answer is negative, then why? Then that's fine.
Yeah, well, really, you know...
Let's move on.
Okay. The one other thing I'd say, these questions are a mix of data questions and opinion questions. And question 11 falls in the opinion category.
Okay.
Although it would, if they have an informed view for why it's not long enough, then we'd ask them to explain why. And we all already know that the majority of URS cases are default determinations. There is never a response, and there's no way to know why the response wasn't given, except in the few instances where the respondent shows up later and asks for an extension or, I forget the technical terms, but comes in later and says, hey, I missed the deadline, but I want, a continuation of the process. But that, we also know, is a fairly rare instance. Okay, Justine, you have a new question, 13A. Has any respondent expressed any difficulty with regard to the 2,500 word limit set for the response? I think that kind of...
The reason why I put this in was just, because we asked the question about the 500 word limit for the complaint, so it just seemed natural to pose the same sort of question in regard to the response. It's
sure.
Not a big deal if we don't want the question to me.
No, I think it's fine, and it's followed up by another question and question 14 about whether the providers think that the balance where the complainant gets 500 words up to 500 and the respondent gets up to 2,500 words is a reasonable balance of word limits.
Sure. And then with question 13, I think we already have the information, so I'm not sure whether we want to ask this question again. The question regarding fees associated with late responses.
Okay. And which question do you think this duplicates?
It doesn't duplicate, but I'm just saying that I think we already have the answers.
Okay. I'm going to look to staff to, let me see.
This is Ariel. It's on the spreadsheet line 50. It's basically spelled out in the supplemental rules of the three providers, and staff have put the information there.
Well, at least in the April 6th spreadsheet, I'm not seeing any response from the providers regarding URS Procedure 5.7.
It's row number 50. Well, maybe the PDF is getting out of date because the Google spreadsheet has been updated. But basically, the supplemental rules have spelled out all the fees related to late responses, and also I think the providers also mentioned that too in their presentation. So,
what question are we talking about? Question 15?
13.
Okay, my mistake. I thought you said 15. Okay, if we've got that answer. If we haven't answered the question already, we don't need to ask the question. So, Ariel, you're saying we already have, we've got, that's basic information on their fee structure. We don't need to ask that.
Correct.
Okay.
And just for efficiency, I will put all the responses on the Google Doc as well, so you don't need to cross-reference, and I can do that after this call.
Okay.
And we can review which ones can be removed.
Okay. All right. Question 15. Uh, I changed this question a little bit to not just ask if they received responses that contain facts and circumstances sought to refute the claim of bad faith registration that were not listed in URS Procedure 5.7. I added a second part to that, were such facts persuasive, and if so, should additional grounds be added to Procedure 5.7? So I went a little bit further, again, trying to drill down and not have to go back and ask further questions. Question 16, I thought it was very confusing as stated. Let's see if you're okay with my rephrasing. What percentage of URS cases were brought against registrants determined to be domain name investors, and then put in parenthetical, holding a portfolio of domain names for traffic monetization and or resale, close parentheses. I thought the question is, as it originally, containing elements of domain name investing, I didn't even know what that means. So this is a more objective question that hopefully they can provide some answer to. Question 17 is just a question to the forum about their supplemental rule 5D double I. And my embellishment tries to again drill down to ask whether the rule has been used, whether any other respondents ought to be separated out and or dismissed, and how the examiners dealt with those requests. So, again, trying to be more comprehensive and focused. I deleted question 18 because it replicated the expanded version of question 17.
Yes, agreed, Bill.
Okay, 18. All right, so we're now 7 minutes past the hour. We have 23 minutes left and 9 pages left. So we're going to go really quick through the rest of this and stipulate that when we close the call, it doesn't mean that anybody's foreclosed from coming back over the next few days and saying, hey, I have an issue with this question. I think it should be rephrased this way, or that's redundant, or we already have the answer. So I want to make clear that the document as it stands at the end of this call can still be amended. I would say let's keep it open till next Monday, and then close of business Monday. We'll assume that's the final document and that we're going to forward it on late Monday or early Tuesday to the full working group, because reviewing all the sub-team questions is going to be before the full working group starting next Wednesday, which means there's another bite at the apple on all of this as well. So this is not the end of the story on any of these questions.
Thanks, Phil. This is Susan. That sounds great.
Yeah.
Could we suggest that if we make edits in this Google Doc, which I think we could make suggested edits anyway in the Google Doc, that we email the group if we do so, just so that we know to have a look at it if someone's made some changes.
I think that's a great suggestion, and that way it relieves us all of having to constantly check the Google Doc. We can go there. If you make a change to the Google Doc, please inform the rest of the group, and we can go look at it, and if we agree with it, we won't say anything. If we disagree, we can put that on the sub-team list. Okay, examiner, let me stop here before I forget. We had an email this morning from Michael Karanikolas. I probably mispronounced his name. Apologies for that. He had two suggestions on this. Let's just bring them up right now. He wanted question 2 amended to read What, if any, training or guidance do you provide for the selected examiners? I don't have a problem with that. Anyone else?
No, no problem.
Okay. And then, well, I guess that's all. Yeah, on question one, he wanted us to, and then we'll go back right back and look at question one. He said, I would appreciate if we could dig a little deeper into question one under examiners, specifically to look into what, if any, proportion of the examiners have experience representing the registrant side, or if they have a tendency to a background representing trademark holders. Let's look at question one and see what we think of that suggestion. How do you select examiners and determine that their backgrounds comport with the URS rules and procedures? And any views on Michael's suggestion that we dig a little deeper and ask about the balance between folks generally representing trademark holders versus domain registrants?
Martin Silva here. I think it's a relevant question to have the data on, because I, at least in my experience in the Dutch American experience of these processes, there is a very huge balance problem there. I think it's at least relevant to have that detail.
So you're agreeing with Michael that we should have something on that?
Yeah, I think it wouldn't hurt. It will help to have just one more data to say later if it's relevant or not, but we should have it.
Okay. So how should we ask that?
See, I'm not so sure that it matters. I mean, I think if we assume that the examiner is going to be biased in favor of whichever type of party they normally represent, then we're really saying we don't think that they're an appropriate person to be able to act in the manner of being a judge, which is effectively what they're doing here. And so I'm not sure that it, that we're making an assumption there, or at least once we get information back, we'll draw some inferences, or potentially draw inferences from who's been appointed as an examiner. But surely that's not relevant. What's relevant is whether they've got the necessary expertise and whether they're capable of deciding a case fairly or not.
Martin here. No, I think it goes a little bit deeper, because this has to do with normal human behavior. When you always have, this is the same case for judges in general, as you said, we assume they are neutral. But if all judges are white, old, from big colleges, and they all play together golf in the same place, and they all read the same books, when you have those sorts of variables that determine it at some level, even in good faith, conscious decisions, it's good to know about it. Even if we decide we don't want to address it specifically further, it's good we know that. It's not an irrelevant detail to understand how the process works and how the decisions are being made. Again, this doesn't mean we have to act upon that data. It is data that is relevant when you are trying to analyze, very specifically the process.
Hi, this is Cynthia. Could I jump in for just a second?
Absolutely.
Thank you. We're talking about the URS, right? And the URS mm-hmm. was designed to be an avenue for brand owners to quickly take down obviously offending content. So, I mean, should we not kind of assume that folks that are bringing URSs are mostly brand owners?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. All the complainants are brand owners. They're trademark owners. What we're discussing is whether, and I, well, let me say this. I agree with Susan that, regardless of whether, assuming the examiner is an attorney in private practice, because generally people working for a company wouldn't be URS examiners. They wouldn't be permitted by their company to have that as a sideline. Whether in their day-to-day practice they generally represent trademark owners or domain registrants in domain-related disputes should be irrelevant. The relevant question is, are they neutral? Because they'd be unethical if they weren't neutral. No attorney who generally represents trademark owners should be a U.S. examiner if their general view is that the respondent's always guilty. From the other side, if you generally represent domain registrants, you shouldn't be the examiner if you're always looking for a way to dismiss the case.
But why are we assuming that domain owners are not also trademark owners? Most of the ones that I know are. And, I mean, here's where we're getting into this thing. URS is designed for a certain particular purpose, and now we're talking about these, you know, what is the capacity for these folks? Do they normally represent? Well, but these are not clear-cut. These are not clear-cut cases of this is a brand owner or a trademark owner and this is a domainer. Those people are interchangeable. You can be a domainer and own trademarks, and you can own trademark. You can be a trademark owner and also be a domain and a domain purveyor or investor. If these folks have not identified themselves as a brand owner or a domainer, then how does the provider assess what kind of client or what kind of party that this person represents? In other words, I think that we're trying to insert an element that the provider can't really, they can't answer. It would have to be the person answering the question, and then there's going to be shades of black and white. Do you call yourself, if you own a 20 domains and a single trademark, are you a domainer or are you a brand owner? You might be both.
No, but I think that's the wrong aim of the question. We are aiming at examiners, not a complainant or respondent.
Martin, hi, it's Susan. Sorry, can I leap in? I think what Cynthia is saying is, though, that, you know, in determining whether the examiner, you know, mostly acts for domainers or mostly acts for registrants, mostly acts for trademark owners, what Cynthia is saying is that these those labels are fluid. And so, how does anyone even determine if an exam, you know, certainly at the level of the provider, how do you even determine which camp you put an examiner in, and what relevance is it anyway? And I mean, here's an example. I mean, John Berryhill, for example. I mean, I think most of us would say, you know, he generally is viewed as someone who is very sought after for domain, you know, by domain registrants to be their representative in defending them in UDRP cases, or presumably also in URSs, but he's not exclusively a representative for people who are always on the receiving end of these complaints. He does act on both sides, and I'm quite confident that he's entirely capable, in accordance with, you know, with his rules of professional ethics, of deciding a decision fairly based on the facts before him, and not taking a demeanor stance just because he's on a, you know, were he to be an examiner.
I'm,
okay.
Martin here. I'm not trying to preconceive whether examiners are neutral. I agree with you. Most of them are very, very neutral in the professional way, and they are ethics law behind it that are far beyond what we can do here. But again, it would be a surprise if you find out that there's not a mix. There's not such a gray area. I mean, I think that I agree with you. I also intuitively think that most of them are gray areas. They defend, they in their private practices, they defend both trademarks and both registrants. But maybe that's not the case. Maybe the data will show us they're all only trademark owners. In that sense, I don't want to play with the language, but I understand that behind this question, the idea is to see, not whether the examiner exclusively defends people that doesn't have trademarks, but rather if it defends constantly on this private practice, trademark protections against registrants, or registrants against trademark claims. Again, I don't think this is a useless piece of data. I'm not jumping to conclusions. I'm just saying it's not irrelevant.
This is Phil. I have just jumped to a conclusion. My conclusion is that this is a controversial suggestion from Michael. if we try to decide it now, it's only going to be relitigated at the full working group level. So I'm going to sideline it and save it for the full working group to discuss, pointing out that we have other questions in this section about what have the providers done when it's been confirmed that an examiner was not independent and was biased, and what do they do about it? I think that's the relevant question. I think we assume that regardless of their day-to-day practice, that examiners take an oath to be neutral when they perform this examiner role, and the relevant question is have any examiners been shown to be biased and not to be neutral. So let's sideline the question and put this aside for further discussion.
Can I make one final comment very quickly?
Sure.
Is just that I don't think that Martin's question is necessarily controversial. I think it's unanswerable. I think that's the problem. It's unanswerable. What is GoDaddy? Is GoDaddy a domainer because they have a portfolio of hundreds of thousands of domains, or are they a trademark holder? They're both. I mean, yep. When you try to separate into a camp, do you represent mostly A or B, but there's a whole bunch of C out there. I think it's unanswerable by the provider.
Yeah, and I'll have to say most of the attorneys I know who, even if they primarily represent domain investors, they also take cases sometimes from trademark holders. So trying to put them in one category or the other gets very murky. Can we move? We have 9 minutes left. So can we move on? Okay.
First of all, it's not my question. I'm just trying to bring some noise to the debate when I see I can make some. So it's not my question per se. Second, I agree with Phil. Let's put it forward for later. Let's just try to keep Michael's original idea rather than my own defense of it, just for the respect of his comments.
Yeah, well, again, these questions are all going to be reviewed at the full working group level, and Michael hopefully can be on that call and can forward his suggestion, and we can have this discussion at the full level. But I don't want to spend any more time on it here, because whatever we decide, if we included it, it's going to be debated again. So let's just have that debate at the full working group level. Let's go down here quickly. We're going to have to skip a bunch of questions. And again, after this call, everybody has up till Monday morning to make any comments or suggestions for deleting or editing any of these questions. When you do so, notify the working group that you've made a change in the Google Doc so we can look at it, and then we'll shut down the document at the close of business Monday and forward it in its state at that point for full working group review. So I'm going to focus here on a couple of other questions in the examiner section which get to this impartiality. Question 6 was unchanged. Question 5 was just clarified about conflict of interest and how do you make the examiners aware of their obligation to be impartial and independent. So we've got plenty of questions on that issue. Question 7 just edited to oath, any oath, and affirmation that they'll be neutral and independent. Question 8 edited to be much shorter about whether the providers undertake any independent inquiry about independence and neutrality, impartial and independent. Question 9 asked if any examiners have voluntarily disclosed any conflict. And then follows up with what did you do if you found out they had an undisclosed conflict. And if the conflict was disclosed, was this done before or during the case? It's possible an examiner might only realize they had a conflict once they had been appointed and got into this case. Question 10 asks about the respondent's ability to allege any conflict of interest or bias on the part of the examiner and how they do so. We have like 6 or 7 different questions here, all about variations on discovering and how dealing with conflict of interest. So I'm going to skip down. We've got a bunch of questions on the language because of the requirements and the rules and procedures that proceedings be conducted in the language of the registrant. And I believe all my edits are simply clarifying it. It's nothing substantive. All right, further statement, not worth discussion. In-person hearings, minor edit. Withdrawal, it's a very technical question about only to the forum, about some inconsistency in language they use. By the way, an inconsistent language, I don't have time on this call, but I will tell you that it's very important in statutes or any other documents that language pertaining to the same subject be consistent, because I was involved when, as a banking lobbyist, when the Federal Reserve essentially deregulated through regulation the ability of banks to underwrite securities, and that's because of a difference in one word in two parts of the Federal Reserve Act. So a lot can be built on a inconsistency of a single word. So it's good to ask the forum about this. Yes?
Absolutely agree with you, Phil.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Bill Clinton had a problem getting consistency on the word is, so I'm with you, Phil.
Yes. Well, that was about meaning, not consistency. Yeah, by the way, that inconsistency in the banking law was between principally engaged and substantively engaged. So it was about the difference between principally and substantively. Default, Justine put in a reference to Procedure 6.2. I think that's fine to clarify what we're asking about. The rest of the edits are strictly clarifying. Let's go down to question 5 under examining determination. I made quite a bit of changes there about guidelines referred to in URS Rule 13C. And I suggested that question should probably be struck as the rule language refers to guidelines as Delaney set forth in the provider's supplemental rule. So I question whether there's really any reason to ask that, and thought that we should just be asking a question to the ADNDRC.
Which question are you on, Phil?
Question 5 under examiner determination. That's on page 10.
Okay, right. Yes, that was the intention of that question when I posted it to begin with. Yeah, just going back, question 3. Now this is kind of like a repeat of what we considered earlier. So I don't know whether we should remove question 3 altogether, or whether we should put the earlier question here. I mean, that's something to think about, because it's definitely a repetitive question in this section.
Yeah, well, if it's repetitive, I think it belongs in the prior section, but I think I agree that this is repetitive and we can probably strike it.
Yes, then you should just delete this.
Yeah, let's just delete question 3. And Justine, I want to get down to question 6. You put in some lengthy additional language. How to form an MSD compelled. What's that?
It was just by explanation, because you remarked that it was unclear and requires further discussion. So I'm posing the background to this question.
Okay. Well, let me prevail upon you. Since you pointed that out, could I ask you to take a shot at redrafting it and posting that to the Google Doc and letting us know when you do?
Sure. Can do.
Thank you. Thank you. And we're at the end of the call, so I'm going to scroll through very quickly here, ask for indulgence for 3 more minutes, see if there's anything else that appears to be more than just a typographical clarification. And I'm scrolling down.
The last question, I'm not quite sure what we're trying to get at.
The very last question in the document?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
And this is Ariel.
You know what? Question 9 is the question that George Kirikos raised San Juan meeting where the providers and this is my comment at the end of this question. I'm glad you brought this up, Justine. I've wrote, this question was asked and answered by the forum representative in San Juan, as it does not relate to the rules, procedures, technical requirements, or supplemental rules. Should it be posed to them? My personal view is that it should not, that it's not the job of this working group to ask the forum about a lawsuit initiated almost 10 years ago and settled with the Minnesota Attorney General. We should be looking at whether the forum and the other two providers are operating in conformity with the URS rules and procedures. And if they are, then this prior accusation against the forum 8 years ago is irrelevant, in my view. And if they're not, that lawsuit's not going to inform us one way or the other what kind of job they're doing on the URS. So I don't personally believe that this working group should be posing this question again to the forum, particularly since they already provided an answer in San Juan. What other?
Well, I completely agree, and I believe that it's come up more than once in our working group as well. And so, the previous forum representative, I believe, also answered the question on one of our working group calls. But I totally agree. In any event, I think that this is not relevant. And if there were concerns about the appointment of the forum as being an appropriate provider to be offering URS services, then that's really something that should have been brought up with ICANN, but for example, by, you know, making a reconsideration request or some other, you know, some other process, rather than trying to shoehorn it into here, where we're trying to review whether all of the providers are doing the job that they've been appointed to do.
Okay. Any other views on that?
Yeah, I agree. So I might ask, I don't know the forum representative well, but maybe it might, if they want something in the record, maybe they should just provide some letter in writing with whatever their answer to that question is. It becomes just part of the documentation of the group, but isn't re-asked. That might settle some of this back.
Yeah. You know, if they want to do that, Lori, it's fine with me. The question is whether this working group should be asking them that question.
No, not at all. Not in this context. I agree with you.
Yeah, so my view is what George sent them the question and asked that they put an answer on the record that can be included wherever they want it.
Sorry, I keep this question because it's just in the consolidated list, and in fact, Forum already answered it in the presentation, and I put the record already in the spreadsheet, so it's all referenced.
So wait, can we keep the question in and just say asked and answered, be the reference?
Well, we're discussing questions that are going to be sent out by this working group to all 3 providers, except where it's a provider-specific question. So I don't believe we should be keeping it if we're not going to be asking it.
All right, I'm just wondering.
We make a record of it that it's been answered in the table.
Yeah, that's what I would
like to do, though. I'd like to actually keep it in and reflect it's been answered.
Oh, in the table.
In the table, Lori, not in the list of questions that's going out to.
Okay, I agree.
Yeah.
Let's keep it in the table and note that it was asked and answered in San Juan. Since we're going to be going through all this with the full working group, and George is on every full working group call I can remember, I'm sure he'll raise it again.
Yep.
And we can discuss it again.
But perhaps we could try not discussing it again. I mean, you know, there is a point at which he can't keep raising stuff that is not relevant to our work.
Yeah, I mean, this is the whole problem, Phil. Like, how do we manage this? Because it's purposefully disruptive. And I think we have to start purposefully managing it. It's otherwise it again becomes out of control, and at some point it's going to come back to us. And it just can't keep coming up.
Yeah.
And I think that's something Kathy should deal with, because, you know, I think maybe it would be easier for her to deal with it than for you to do so, Phil.
All right. Well, you know, we alternate sharing the calls, but if George brings it up, you know, I don't want to be specific to one person. These calls are transcribed. I think in general, if working group members feel that a particular member, whoever it might be, is trying to act in a dilatory or divisive way, probably the best way to deal with that is not to keep getting into an extended debate, but just to say, you know, we don't think it was the determination of the sub-team that the working group should not be asking this question, that it's not relevant to our charter responsibilities, and besides that, it's already been asked and answered in San Juan.
Yeah, I wouldn't even say besides that. That's where the arguing comes in. That's my point, Phil. I would keep it as brief as possible. Here's the question, asked and answered. I think if the same person is reasking a question, that's different. I agree. We shouldn't call individuals out. We're all speaking, you know, for different, you know, we have a variety of hats on sometimes when we speak. But I do think if a particular individual is asking a question repeatedly and is answered repeatedly, then it's okay to say, asked and answered, done.
Well, let me also observe, not thinking of any particular person, that if any member of the working group ever believes that another member of the working group is acting in a divisive or dilatory or disruptive manner, or is violating ICANN's expected standards of behavior, they can file a formal complaint with the chairs that must be considered. And the guidelines set out a process for that. So keep that in mind. We're 7 minutes past the scheduled end of the call. I want to thank everybody in the sub-team for doing a lot of work and a lot of good work. I think we got an awful lot done in a very short time. We picked up the pace. I think we have a very sound work product to bring back to the full working group. Again, I'm going to ask everybody over the next 2 days before the weekend, because I know people don't want to work on the weekend, just go through the Google Doc as it stands now. If you have any further views on anything that should be deleted or changed in any way, go ahead and propose that. Let us know on the email list. Also take a look at the MFSD and ADN-DRC supplemental rules. See if you think any other questions regarding something that's unique or something that's out of conformance with ICANN's rules and procedures for the URS needs to be flagged and a question asked about that. And that's it. We're going to keep the document open till the end of Monday. Let me ask staff, what's usually considered close of business on an ICANN day? Is it 5 p.m. Pacific time, or how do you do that?
How about I just make it 23:59 UTC on Monday? That's about 8 p.m.
Okay. Midnight in London, which is 8 p.m. in New York and Washington, and 5 p.m. in L.A., so on the West Coast. So the doc will be open till 23:59 on Monday. And it will be whatever form it's in. At that point, it's going to be shut down, and that document will be sent out to the full working group on Tuesday morning as a focus for discussion on our full working group call next Wednesday. But I think we've got a solid document here. We might tinker with it a bit more, but I would expect that after one or two full working group calls, we can not just this document, but the questions prepared by the practitioners and the document subteam will be in a position to get those questions out this month and get responses back in May. So we're keeping our timeline on URS. I know there's a proposal to move URS to phase two. We've the co-chairs have asked working group members to weigh in on that, and we're committed that if there's substantial support for that, we'll have a full working group discussion late April, early May, but certainly in time that if there is substantial support to get a request to council for their May meeting. But right now we're going to keep doing our work, and even if policy decisions or URS are put off for phase two, that doesn't mean the data gathering can't be done now. So everybody good with that?
Yes.
Yep.
Great.
Okay.
Yes. Thanks very much, Phil.
Thank you, Phil.
Thanks, everyone, and we'll see y'all. Please give this another, 20, 30 minutes of your attention between now and the weekend, and we'll see y'all on the full working group call next Wednesday. Goodbye.
Great. Bye.
Thanks, John,
bye.
Everyone.
Thank you, everyone, for joining. Dale, can you please stop the recording?